This was a freshman? Okay, any questions or comments on what we had last hour? We seem to have got caught up on the last one, the perfectionist. Were there any of the others you wanted to talk about? I went through those 10 least wanted men rather quickly. Okay. Come now to the, if not to the gracious word. And this is very important. This may seem trivial. If you think it is, then change your mind because you're wrong. The gracious word. Marriage is a never, I'm reading now, is never static. It is an organism of in process, either of growing or of dying. You got that? Your marriage is either growing or dying. Marriage is a continuing creation. The primary creative dynamic of both good and bad families is the spoken word. Look at that last sentence, students. I worked all night on that, so you ought to memorize it. The primary creative dynamic, you understand? Marriages are moving. They're becoming something. What is the primary, not the only, but the primary creative dynamic, whether you're creating a good marriage or a bad one? It's the spoken word. You can think of an illustration or analogy of this, Genesis 1. How did God create the world? He said, let it be. He spoke it into existence. And listen, and that's in, I don't want to spiritualize that text. This just reminds me that there's a sense in which we speak our marriage into existence. Do you realize, we're going to come to this later, we talk about children. You create children. You create people. What is the primary creative dynamic? What you say to them. The spoken word. Now, what we say, I'm reading again now, and how we say it is almost exclusively a matter of choice. And I have put that in all capital letters. This is a matter of choice. We choose to say what we say and how we say it. Because of man's sinful nature, we can criticize one another endlessly and seldom, if ever, stray from the naked truth. The issue here is not between what is true and what is false. See, some people have the idea that if it's true, it needs to be said. If I find somebody in the church who says, well, I'm quoting now, a woman actually said this one time, the way I believe is, if I think it, I just might as well say it. You ever run anybody like that? Well, whenever I run anybody like that, I make it a policy to stay a minimum of 10 miles away from them, if possible. I'm going to just, my rule is, get away from me. I don't want anything to do with you. Go pollute somebody else's world. Why? It doesn't work that way. You see, it's a matter of choice. Now, this is very, very important, students, and I don't know what kind of home you grow up in, but you see, there can be a spirit of law or a spirit of grace in the home. Now, it depends on what, primarily on what is said and how it is said. You see, we are fallen, here's what I mean by this. We are fallen creatures, are we not? We sin, we are inconsistent, we forget, we get tired, we mess up, don't we? Say yes. We mess up regularly, don't we? Say yes. Now, and when you get married, what you got is one person who messes up, marrying another person who's always messing up and doing it wrong. Now, listen to me. You can, it's like in a church. I've seen churches pick themselves apart and nobody ever lied. Everything they said was the truth. But you see, if we want to criticize each other, there is so much raw material to work with that we can do nothing but criticize each other and always be truthful. And I have seen husbands and wives pick their marriage to pieces, and I have seen parents dismantle children and always tell the truth. That is, the faults were real, the shortcomings were genuine.
I picked up on this one time when I was doing more counseling than I am now, and I never was a very good counselor. I was counseling some troubled teenagers, and every one of them, there would be certain things they would always say, no matter what their problem was. You could just write it down in a little black book and bet on it. Certain things, if a teenager was troubled, they would always say. One of the things they would always say is, they would say this, "Boy, if I do something great or good, I never hear a word. But boy, let me mess up, and my dad's all over my case." What they were saying is, the only time I ever got my dad's, especially, full attention was when I messed up. I could do 10 things right or 100 things right, never a word. But you let me do something wrong, and boy, I get his full attention. He comes down on me like ugly on an ape. Now, what's happening there? You see, but you, just because something is true, students, you don't have to say it. You don't have to talk about it. There is no rule that's come down from Mount Sinai or anywhere else, not from heaven, that says you've got to say it. There is nothing wrong with keeping your mouth shut sometimes. And, you see, what about the good things? You see, in every home, there is the good, there's the bad, there's the positive, and there's the negative. Now, I'm not talking about some Pollyannish kind of unreality. I'm not talking about Disney and Dream World and Alice in Wonderland. Do you have to deal with negative things as they come up? Yes, you do. You can't ignore the negative, all the negative. Some things you have to address, and we do it every day. But what I'm saying is that you can create a climate in a home, an atmosphere, primarily by what we say, and we can either operate by grace or by law. These are the underlying principles I've tried to teach you. Grace, that is, we can tend to focus upon and emphasize the things that are right and good, and maybe overlook some of the things that are bad, and some of the things that are bad are never going to change. Listen, let me tell you young people this, and you, the old married men over here will bear me out on this. You marry that man or that woman, that boy or that girl, and they're going to be doing things that irritate you the first day of your marriage, and they're going to be doing it. You've been married 5 years, they're still doing it, and you've told them a number of times, they just have not repented. And listen, on your 50th wedding anniversary, they're still going to be doing some of those things that irritate you, and they will not get the message. And I got news for you. You're doing things that irritate them.
Amen. Amen.
Now you, and they aren't going to change. Understand? Some things aren't. You talk about change, Tim. Some things are not going to change. Now, fortunately for my wife, I have gotten rid of all my shortcomings. But other than the fact that I can't, I'm not always objective. But other than that, I don't have any shortcomings. But my wife, she still has shortcomings, and I've tried to reason with that woman and get her to repent. And she still, you quote me Friday. Well, listen.
He'll be gone.
I'll be a safe distance away. Now, here's what I'm saying. That now, what are you going to do about it? You got this marriage in which you got two imperfect people doing things that bother, doing things that are not necessarily perfect, things that ought to be done. What are you going to do about it? You get these imperfect kids. What are you going to do about it? Listen, what you say and how you say it creates what I call a sweet air in the home. You can walk into a church or a home, and you don't have to be there very long before you know whether the air is good or bad. And you want to stay or you want to leave. And when the air is bad, kids tend to, as soon as they get... One of the reasons a lot of kids want their driver's license, right? The first day they're eligible. Why? They want to get out of the house. I'm gone. That's not the only reason. But what do you say? Look what I say here. After... Every marriage has those negative factors that will never be eliminated. The principle undergirding the spoken word is grace. We choose to emphasize the positive rather than the negative. When you go home, I ask you this. I don't want to see any show of hands. And this is about as personal as I'll get in this class. But just ask yourself this question. When you were 16 years old, when you were home, were you glad to be there? Or were you not, you see? Well, why were you glad to be there or not glad to be there? Well, you see, nobody like... Let me ask you this. Do you like to be somewhere where everybody's always putting you down? No. I don't. Adults don't like that. What do we think kids do? That's what I heard kids say. My folks do nothing but put me down. Always put me down. Well, do you have to put a kid down sometimes? Yeah, sometimes you got to land on him. But are you building? Are we building or are we destroying? After many years of marriage, I'm reading now, a wife's self-image is largely the product of what has been said to her by her husband. The primary source of man's self-esteem is his work. The primary source of his wife's self-esteem is her husband. Now that's true to one degree or another in various homes. Here's the rule. The negative clings indefinitely. The positive must be reaffirmed often every day. The negative clings indefinitely. The positive must be reaffirmed. Learn that. Memorize that. Write it on your skin somewhere, your forehead, your wrist, and look at it and read it. And you got to say it. What we tend to do if we don't think about it, students, is that we go through and we never really say anything until something goes wrong. You understand? We assume that the good is natural, the wrong is unnatural. Therefore, we don't talk about the good; we talk about the negative. And it's a terrible way. And I'll just give you a personal testimony. This is one of the hardest lessons I ever had to learn. What kind of home, what kind of flavor, what kind of atmosphere do you create in your home? Do your kids want to be there? Do other people's kids want to be there? How's the air? Now, again, I'm not talking about unreality. What do you do? Listen, what you say, and tune me in, fellas. In a home, this is just the nature of things, don't ask me why, but what a man says carries more weight than what his wife says. That is, a man with less effort can affect the mood or the flavor or the atmosphere of the home than his wife. It takes less effort than does his wife. A lot of men think it's their job to keep things strict, to take the joy out of them. Do you realize an angry father can take more joy out of a home in 5 minutes than his wife can put in 5 years? And this is the way it is, fellas. If there's a man in the home, there is a father, whether that home is a place of joy, whether it's a positive thing, whether it's a negative thing, depends overwhelmingly on the man. The men decide. You understand? If a man is going to poison the air in a home, his wife cannot stop him. She cannot counteract it.
When your kids were growing up, and you still got a couple that are in high school, when they do something wrong that you're not there, do you all have a set of rules on how, when you come home, how your wife tells you, or she tells you as soon as you hit the door, or she waits, or how do you handle something like that? Because I know that's can be a big influence on how you handle it.
We've never had very much of that. Usually, only very seldom does anything come up that she can't handle. And she'll appeal to me once in a while. If I'm there, I'm usually aware of what's going on. We don't have any set rules, no. Common sense.
My mom is my stepmom, and she never would carry anything out with us. I mean, because her daughter she would, but the three boys who weren't hers, she always said, "Wait, so you probably get something as soon as you get the door." She let it happen, and she let us have it. And I just wonder if there's any
very bad
advice
yeah.
she would give.
Yeah, he's the bit. What is? He's the executioner is home. This is his black hood, you know, and his noose. And the Grim Reaper is here. Come on in, Dad. That's not fair to the father. My wife has not done that. Only extreme cases. For me, she beat me at the door and said, "You got a kid you got to deal with." But
you don't know what your son's done.
Yeah, but that's very seldom.
Once in a while, a couple of times I've been on the phone and said, here, I need you to talk to somebody. And I've talked to them on the phone. And
something that Professor Buddy has taught us, depending on what kind of thing the child did, but usually the attention span of the child will not last until the father gets home, and it's better to deal with it right then. And also,
younger child's
the
better.
Effect of the punishment won't be as strong as it is.
Well, we're going to come to that with disciplining children later on. Right now, I want to come back to my subject, although there is a connection. Let me be more mainline here. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, what are you going to say and what are you not going to say? You could say, for instance, what's the difference? And this is reality, students. This is reality. This is the way it works. This is practical. This is the nuts and bolts. What is the difference? Say in the morning, you got teenage children, boys or girls. What is the difference between when the father? Now we'll talk about the father because his word carries more weight than her word, the nature of things. What's the difference between a father who says nothing to his teenage 16 or 17 or 14 year old son or daughter? Except he says, "Don't forget that you've got to have the backyard rake when I get home. Remind them of some chore, or say, hey, I heard that your mother told me that your math grade went down half a grade last time. What's going on? Somebody not say that. What's the difference between saying that or saying nothing?" Or walking over to a kid when they're getting ready for school and hug them, whether they want to be hugged or not, and say, "Hey, I told you lately, I really like what you're becoming. I told you lately, I'm glad you're mine." What's the difference? Is there any difference? Let me tell you, the difference is the difference between life and death. That's what the difference is. A lot of kids are dying today. It doesn't take much to give life. The word creates. You can create a whole different child for a whole day. You can grab a teenage boy, take my word for it, and you can tease him and shake him, kiss him on the head and say, look him right in the eye and say, "You know, don't you, Adam, that if there's ever a daddy loved a boy, I love you and I'm proud of you. You go get him today." That's a different boy all day. If his dad's told him that. Is that so much? See how easy that is? Now, if you were never raised that way, you'll suffer death learning how to do it. But it's worth it. What's the difference? Hugs are cheap. What's the difference between a hug and no hug? Physically, it's no difference at all. Time, a couple of seconds. But again, it's a difference between life and death. It's that much of a difference. And you say things. You can say to your wife, she thinks she'll say, "Oh, you're being silly." You can say things like, "Told you yet today how lucky I am to have you. Every time I see you, you can say to your wife, "Well, I'd rather see you first thing in the morning than Elizabeth Taylor, because you're better looking." That's stupid. Say, "Honey, before you leave the house, say, honey, I'm going to be thinking about you all day." You see, it's not big stuff. It's little stuff. Let me tell you, you create air, create tone. Or you can have something else. It all depends. It's a matter of choice. The gracious word. The word, old King James talks about the word fitly spoken.
It all depends on whether you say it or not, and how, what you say and how you say it. Do you have any questions on this? Does this seem silly to you? Well, listen, it's one of the most profitable things you can do. So when you do have to talk about the negative, you've made room for it. You've created space for it. You know, when you do have to come down on a kid and say, look, this is going to stop. If you've spoken 10 gracious words, if you've spoken 20 gracious words, when you have to speak the negative word, let me reword that. If you've spoken 10 positive words, when you have to speak the one negative word, you can speak it without destroying something. But if you haven't said the positive words and you speak only to speak the negative, then you will destroy it. You'll destroy kids. Listen, there are kids, do you realize there are kids going into the fifth grade in Osceola County who are already defeated, who are already lost. They're losers, and they'll be losers all their life. They're already defeated because their dads have taken the life out of them by what they've said to them and how they've said it. They're already done for. And not even into puberty yet.
You might want to wait to answer this question, but I have a problem when I'm with someone else's children, and like say someone takes something from someone else, and the one kid just absolutely devastated and all upset, and I just want to say, you know, what's the big deal? And I change my voice, the tone of my voice isn't what it should be, and I think, is it because they're not my kids, or is it always hard to come down to their level and understand that this is a major thing? Does it get easier when they're yours?
Yes.
I know.
It does get easier when they're yours. Yeah, we're going to come back to that kind of thing later, but that's a good question. Do you have any comments on Leslie? Do you have any comments on this? I can't stand a coward.
Ooh, you should hear.
Well, always like your
sound. Listen, when they get to be 21, they still need it. A positive word, especially from their dad.
How much of a difference can we make to these kids as ministers? We're all going to be in ministry with kids at one time or another. How can we make a difference?
You can make some difference by dealing with other kids, other people's kids this way. Some kids are just. We have a case in our church right now where the preacher has had a real effect on the young person because he's spoken a positive word. And the parents, I think, are not very good at it. They have a real effect.
Well, sometimes the small things that you say, a parent can destroy them in about 5 seconds.
Pardon?
They lose it a lot of times. Because I work with kids, some of the kids that I've got, you try and give a cheerful word, then they get home to their parents, and the parents tear apart. But you said so forgotten.
That's true.
You've lost several things.
It's hard to work against the parents. You can't do much about it. But I hope you'll listen, I'm speaking mainly to the men. If you were not raised by a father who spoke the gracious word, then you're gonna have to learn to do it. And it's tough. It is tough. Right. Start with the little work to work up. But I'll tell you, I used to do scientific experiments when I was preparing for teaching this kind of stuff.
Okay.
On you. You could see a physical change in a kid. Now, it's interesting. LeAngela, she would come in, when she was just a little kid, say 6, 7, 8 years old. She'd come in and she'd been having a rough day. And seven-year-olds have rough days too. And you say, you grab the kid and you look at him and you shake him and you tease him and pinch their bottom, whatever you have to do, get their attention. And you say, Have I told you lately that I think you're great? I'm so glad you decided. I'm so glad you decided to come live in my house, not somebody else's house. Now, when you told that to LeAngela, she would run. She would just turn around, just pure delight. She couldn't stay. She just. Leslie would skip. She was a skipper. You just watch. I said, Lynn, watch this. And I'd grab Leslie and say that. She'd skip. You know. And Aaron would beam. And Adam wanted to wrestle. He thought, you know, that was his reaction. You know, he'd grab you and he'd start teasing you and want to pick a fight with you. And so now when they get to be bigger, sometimes you got to run them down and speak the gracious word. They get embarrassed, especially boys. I don't care. You know, I'm bigger than they are. And if I want to speak the gracious word, I'll speak it. If I have to hold them, pardon me, not much. But if I have, sometimes I have to hold them down to speak the gracious word, but it has the same effect. Let me tell you this. If you want to have leverage with your kids, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but this is a natural overlap. If you want to have leverage with your kids, you know what leverage is? So that you can, they'll listen to you. They'll care what you think. They'll take your advice. Learn from your experience at least something. If you want to have leverage with your kids, you better keep them on your side. And don't do it by being a namby-pamby permissive parent. You make sure your kids know that you like them. You understand? If you like your parents, and if you know your parents like you, they have leverage with you. But boy, if ever once the parent conveys the message to the kid, I don't like you, your leverage is gone. That kid, it doesn't matter what you say, you're just blowing your nose. You understand? You have lost your influence. You ever notice that you don't listen to people you don't like? Even if they're right, you'll do something else. Just because you don't like them. Okay, the gracious word. I wish I could just shoot off firecrackers or march a brass band through here or do something to impress upon you how simple this is, but how profoundly important it is. The husband-wife relationship. I tell you, I can look at a woman who's been married. I can look at a kid when they come to Bible college, and I can look at their faces. Even if they've been here a year or two or 3 years, and I can tell whether they were raised with the gracious word or not. It shows on their face, especially girls. Girls cannot hide it. And I can look at a woman who's been married to the same man for 15 or 20 years, and listen, you can tell whether she's had grace or law. It shows on her face. You get a woman who's been married to the same man 15 years, and every day he's told her how great he thinks she is and how lucky he knows he is to have her. Understand? And it shall show on her face. Yes? Oh, yes. But I believe, yes, it does. But I believe this. Now listen, don't misunderstand. This is what the Bible says. The woman is the weaker vessel. What does that mean? Well, the Bible, Paul teaches this. It doesn't mean she's inferior. It means she is more vulnerable, among other things. Women are more vulnerable to their husbands than the husbands are to their wives. Men are vulnerable. Understand? But the impact of the spoken word on the husband is there. Very much, isn't it, fellas? Very much there. But a lot of men don't realize that the power of their words on their wife is greater than the power of his wife's words on the man. Now, there are many reasons for that. That's true. Be careful what you say to her, fellas. You see, you create a woman, really. You create a person. You create a marriage. And I know we got good friends. And I don't think I've ever heard him speak a gracious word to her. And she shows it in very interesting ways. Well, and it's not always fancy things. Like, honey, you've had a hard day, haven't you? Don't worry about it. So just fix me a sandwich for supper. All right, yeah, you've earned it. You know, don't worry about it. Woman comes home, she had a hard day, she's worked half a day, she's had to go shopping and two or three things went wrong. You know, she likes a man who says, hey, I noticed that you've had a rough day. I care. Anything I can do to help you tonight? That didn't cost much. It's the difference between saying, hey, what time is supper going to be ready? Is that much difference? You add those up to a marriage, so it's a huge difference. Well, you think about that. Any questions on it? Then we come to prophetic grace. Awarding credit for virtues, look at this, students, and positive qualities in anticipation, not in present fact. Now, this is one of my contributions, my wife and my contributions to the science of family life, prophetic grace. You understand what grace is. Often when a person really, frankly, has deserved the negative word, you give them the positive word. She says, I'm going to give you an example now. I'm trying to tie all this together. Young men, did you ever get a real rotten meal from your wife? I mean, it was really terrible. Now, sometimes it happens. What do? And she cooks something and it really is an inedible. When you're young.
When you're young, you make a mistake
of telling
that.
Yeah. I've been married for, my wife, you come home, listen, this is real now, this is real life. You come home kind of looking forward to a nice hot meal with meat and potatoes, and she's really had a rough day. And she got home an hour later than she thought she could, and a couple of people in the church called, and the time got away from her. This is real life now. And so what you get is warmed over casserole from two nights before. What do you say?
Thank you.
No. Listen. And she says, honey, she feels bad. She says, honey, you've seen this before. She's a little bit apologetic. What do you say? Now you can be an oaf. You can be a real dunderhead, and you can say, well, man, when a man comes home, he deserves better than this. Or he can say nothing, which is just as bad. He can grumble and say, oh, it's okay. He can say, well, it's okay, when she knows it isn't. Or you can say, honey, it doesn't make any difference. It may not be up to your usual high standards, but as long as I can eat it with you, I don't care what you serve me. So now, you got this? Listen. You can say, look, the wife like you, I got no reason to complain. Just sit down and talk to me and it'll taste better. You know, after you, do you realize that after you've eaten something, it doesn't matter what you ate anyway. Understand? If you ate steak or you had casserole, after you're finished, it doesn't matter what you ate. It doesn't matter, but it matters what you said. You understand? It matters what you said. You understand? It'll matter all evening and all day tomorrow and all the rest of your marriage what you say. Do you get the point? Now, that's grace.
If you're not raised, you said men particularly, if they're not raised in a home that the father does this, is it more difficult for them to learn to do that?
More difficult than you can imagine. I'm talking about the gracious word. And what do you say after a meal? Do you say nothing, or do you say, honey, that's a good meal, thank you? You fellas thank your wife for a meal, every meal? Okay, now, listen to me. That's grace. What is prophetic grace? What is prophetic grace?
It is giving credit for virtues and positive qualities in anticipation, not in present fact. You give credit ahead of time. This is especially true for children. Few men have risen to heights of accomplishment who were not simply driving themselves to become, now look at this, students, to become that which an important woman in their life has already declared them to be. Now there's there's a female side of that too. You got that? Let's read that again. Few men have risen to heights of accomplishment who are not simply driving themselves to become that which an important woman in their life has already declared them to be. Now, that important woman is usually a wife, it can be a mother, in some cases a mistress, but it's an important woman in their life. Women create men. As well as the other way around. Here's what I'm saying. What do? You give credit ahead of time. Do you young women know how important it is that you give your husbands credit ahead of time? Men have very fragile egos. Do you know how important it is to give them credit ahead of time? If you give the average fellow, unless he's a real idiot, or thick-headed, you give the average fella, your young husband, credit for being something he's not quite accomplished. He'll break his neck to become that if you already give him credit for it. And you give a child, take my word for it, you give a child credit ahead of time for being something. Give them credit for what they're becoming, and they'll pay any price to become what you have declared them to be. Now, if that's bad, then they'll do that. If you've declared them rotten, they'll make their calling and election sure. They'll prove you right. If you declare them to be quality, I promise you, all the things, they'll do their best to become quality. When do you tell a child he's doing great? After he's done great, or when he's about to? See, after he's done great, he knows he doesn't need it as much as before. When do you tell a child he's a winner? When he's won? When the race is over? Or do you tell him he's a winner the day before the race? It depends. I'm using race metaphorically, of course. Do you get the point? It's prophetic grace. My wife taught me that. One of my favorite memories is her sitting with a little girl or a little boy in diapers, not a year old yet, up on the lap, you know, bouncing up and down. You wouldn't think the kid understand anything. Holding onto her thumbs. And Linda saying to this child, "Oh, LeAngela, Leslie, it's going to be really something what you're going to be someday. And what you're going to be is going to be special. You're really going to be something. You're not an ordinary child. You're special." Now we're going to come back to that later. But you are special. You give them credit ahead of time. You say to a kid, you tell a kid from the time you ring him, you start a kid on the way home from the hospital. That's when you do it. We always tell our kids two things on the way home from the hospital. Number one, I'm daddy and you're not. This is the system. I'm in charge. They like that better. They don't want to be in charge. And second, you are not ordinary. You're special. You tell a kid he's a thoroughbred from his earliest memory, and by the time he gets to be 5 years old or 6 years old, he'll believe it. He'll be believing it. It'll never occur to him to be anything else. Understand? Now, but if you wait until they're 16 years old and they've met your standards and they measure up, forget it. You're 16 years too late.
Kind of always keep them just a tad off of what, just to keep that growth.
I'm serious. Leslie testified to this. Sit around the kid around the supper table and look around, the daddy can look around the family and say, "Boy, this is a bunch of thoroughbreds if I ever saw them. We raise thoroughbreds around here. We don't raise jerks. Not a jerk in the lot. Not a throwaway in the bunch. They're all the real thing." You tell them that. And you tell them that. And you tell them that. And you tell them that.
called prophetic grace. Pretty soon, they get to believe in it. But you tell a kid he's a loser. He'll be a loser. Since some of you may have been told that, raised to believe that you really can't do it. You ever have a parent say this to you? I don't know what's going to happen to you. I'm really worried about you. You know, where you're going to end up in jail. I'm not making that up. Dad say stuff like that. You're never going to amount to anything. Yeah, you can't do anything right. Well, what do you know? You tell a kid that, pretty soon you got a kid who can't do anything right. You tell a mate, day in, day out, how great they are. They'll be on your bill. It works. Prophetic grace. My wife, when you first married, gave me credit for being a real good preacher. And I was wrong. But she always convinced me that I spent most of my life, if I've ever accomplished anything in life, it's because I've been trying to live up to what my wife already told me I was. You know, she already assumed it, gave me credit for it, and I wouldn't disappoint her for anything. Does that make sense to you? Now, is that unreality? No, it's not. It's prophetic grace. It's not lying. You just give them credit for what they're in the process of being.
Can you get into the act of just going through the motions with these things to implement them in your family?
Yes, it has to be real. It has to be natural.
Because, you know, I'm sitting here just thinking about this thing that I'm going to have to remember and to do. And I do a lot of them now, but it's just like I'm going to have to remember all these little tidbits of information.
What you do is, if you weren't raised this way, or if you're just learning, here's what you do. It's a good point, Tim. What you do is just memorize the words. I'm sorry. Memorize the words, rehearse the speech, make it, and after a while, it becomes natural. It may start out unnatural, especially if you've not been. Especially for men, if you've been raised with a dad that put you down. When you first start saying the positive, the gracious word, it will sound phony to your own ear. But you don't stop. You keep it up, and pretty soon, it's natural. It may not be going in. That's a good point.
It's important, like, for engaged couples to encourage each other, to give them compliments. And I know with Marshall and I, that, you know, we try to do that. And I think when we get married, it's really important to have a lot, because, you know, we always push them, you know, and encouraging each other. And I know that's really helpful, especially me being in school. When there are times where I wanted to just quit.
Yeah. And he says, you can do it, you know, you can do it, you're going to make it. It's very true. And it works. Take my word for it, it works. You see, you can turn your family on, men, or you can turn them off. And some men go through life hitting all the off switches, and hoping somebody else turns them back on. Or you can turn the on switches. You want to turn a kid on? I'm very serious. Just turn a kid on. Turn a wife on. Let me tell you this. Learn this. I may have said this before in other connections. If I did, it's worth saying again. Life will serve you up for nothing, all the misery you want. You got to manufacture your own joy. And the silliest, stupidest thing for a person to do, especially a man, is to manufacture his own misery. You understand? Why should you go to the trouble of manufacturing your own misery when you get all you want for nothing? But you got to manufacture your joy sometimes. You got to create it. And sometimes when things are the worst, the man needs to create some joy. Listen, there are dark times, there are unhappy times that come into every home. And blessed is the man who at those times can come into the home and create some joy out of nothing. Kind of like God, ex nihilo. That is,
there's going to be joy just because you're there and you're going to create it. Sometimes you have to, out of nothing. And you can do it. The woman can do it. The man can do it easier. And women know this. Women are very much at the mercy of their husbands when it comes to joy. Listen, if a man decides that his wife is going to be unhappy, and it works the other way too, the woman decides her husband's going to be unhappy, they're going to be unhappy. We are servants of one another when we become one flesh. And great, the gracious word is a way of, not the only way, the way of creating joy. And, well, you think about it. We're going to talk about the giving of compliments next time. You didn't have to do it, children, whether you got to write S there or not. And I want the name of your egg. And tell us something about it, of your baby. And the name should incorporate eggs in some way. You can tell us all that important. Jim Book?
Benedict.
Oh, my.
More than one Benedict.
Yeah, that's okay. Joe Caputo? What is it?
Herman is the first name.
Can we see Herman? I heard Herman's kind of cute to look at.
Can we see Herman? Herman. You don't want
Herman. Herman wants to see a child. You want to see Herman?
What?
I
want to see it. First, tell us something about your egg. About your, anything remarkable, Jim, about your baby? When was he born?
It's a brace band.
You got a retarded egg?
Profoundly retarded
egg. Somehow that seems to fit. I don't know. Let's see your basket. Show her about your.
It's just this like wrapped around tissue and kind of a couch there.
Have you changed it yet today? What was that? How about you, Joe?
I've got a little custom bed here.
Custom bed? Look at this. Oh, I see this. Everybody, show everybody.
The bed's not supposed to come out.
Oh.
Inside.
It's like a crypt.
You got the string for your wrist?
Yeah.
It looks like you've been a coffin.
Okay.
Inside, he's got a little bed and a little playpen.
Oh,
this is
Opus.
Oh,
he's a punker.
A punk egg. Somehow that fits too. Doesn't it? She has some real parenthood today here. Jeans, Leslie? Show us Gloria. Tell us the full name.
Inexcelsis.
Gloria Inexcelsis.
Dale, yeah.
That's good. I've never heard that one before. Carrie? What's the name?
Oh,
Randy
Jr.
Randy Jr.? That's not exactly what I had in mind.
No.
That's okay. Julia? Clowns? You're just audit. You know, you're taking for credit now. You know. Tell us about your baby.
This is my baby. Her name's Fredrika.
What is it?
Fredrika.
Fredrika. that's good. About like yours.
We're twins.
Okay. Nice basket. Anything unusual about Fredrika that we ought to know? Any personality traits you noticed so far? Well, she's a newborn, you know. You probably got the postpartum blues. Daryl Combs.
Yes. What would you like to know?
This is something. What's the name?
This is just Shelly Ann.
Shelly Ann.
Yes. Shelly Ann, she's got a little boner here on her head. You tape it because she only has a little bit of hair. She has just the cutest little booty that you've ever seen.
You got pictures of the birth? We brought
yeah,
in the hospital?
Not of the birth. Oh, yeah. But we do have pictures if anybody later would like to
you
see.
You got pictures of the.
Pictures of mom and the family.
She was born at 7:55 a.m. Monday, St. Cloud Regional Medical Center. The doctor's name was Foghorn Leghorn.
Pay attention, boy.
Yeah, Foghorn Leghorn.
Got a birth certificate.
Yes.
That's very good. And a diaper bag, a little mobile, and Shelly's going to be very well entertained.
Yes.
Joe Condolucci, you're good.
I have three children.
Yes, yeah, right. You don't need this. Pam Dickerson.
8, 5, and 2.
This is his bassinet for traveling.
What's the male? What's his name?
He's
the
male. His name is Bakewell.
Bakewell?
Bakewell.
Okay.
I never brought him in. Three attempts on his life.
Three attempts on his life by?
Really, you know,
12. By other members of the class? Or?
No, by another car on the way to school this morning and by two students who were
soon to. You'd be careful.
Yeah.
Marty Fisher?
Edward.
Edward? That's good. I like that. Edward.
And he's been kidnapped already.
He's been kidnapped? Tell us anything about Edward you want us to know. Let's see your mask.
Red hair.
Red hair.
Sure.
Is there some joke behind that? Yeah, right.
Basketball.
Brother. Steve Getz? Yeah, right. Jeff Hobby?
Well, we live in St. Cloud, and if you know anything about St. Cloud, the culture of St. Cloud is sort of
yes. Look at there. A cowboy, eh?
Yes, that's right.
Cowboy baby.
His name is Roy. He might have a middle name, we're not quite sure.
Roy? Have Laurie having any maternal instincts emerged yet? None whatever.
No, that's not true. But I'm not.
You gonna end up having to help babysit sometimes?
He's preaching at area men's meeting Thursday. I just can't babysit.
Oh, really? I think you ought to take it with him. Yeah. Yeah. Renee Keene? No, Renee, what's your baby's name?
Maggie.
Maggie. Oh, I like that.
Maggie lives in a little
booty,
and she has to have a
booty
like Daryl.
Maggie
has
a
booty.
Yeah,
I think
she's been sleeping this morning already. She was sweating a whole bunch when she came outside, so I've already had to wipe her face down.
Have you changed it? Have you had to change it? You know, you've got to change it twice a day.
You never need to change.
No, come on.
Twice a day, it's every 4 hours.
Y'all follow the project, huh?
She has two little teddy bears to play with in her little bag.
Okay. David Martin. What's the name? You've got a strange looking baby there.
I had a name, but it was you, so.
Well, you can come with another one.
Nog.
It can be the, huh?
Nog.
Nog? Okay.
Nog. This one's in the teeth.
Okay.
Our dog was going to laugh.
Mark Massengill, you think that you're doing the essay. Melissa?
Peggy.
Peggy? Oh, that's good.
Peggy. Oh,
come
on. And she's unusually quiet.
Peggy is unusually quiet. Okay, Kathy Spangler?
Yeah.
This is Marshall Jr.
This is Agatha.
Agatha? Okay, that's good.
And I also want to mention that she has Agatha.
I would.
Eggheads as parents.
If you knew Marshall.
Jim Stiff, I think that you're doing the essay. Lori Stockwell?
Mine's Western Sizzling.
Oh, brother.
He still looks like Mr. Bill.
And he inherited his father's hair and eye.
That hair looks familiar.
Real.
Yeah, I see it is.
And he's always crying. His mouth is like that.
Does he have a low voice?
He has a real eyeball. But he's got one eye bigger than the other.
Right.
Yeah, those are aspirin.
They are aspirin.
Tim Tedrick?
This is Abe Royale, and he has a, well, you might not want to mark that down like that, because he has a very special innate ability, and he feels that God has created him to undergo a sex change. And no joke, this afternoon, he will go under massive facial surgery. He will go under massive other types of surgery, and he will change into a girl. Oh. So, and her name will be Keg.
Keg. Is there a reason for that?
Yes. I've always favored girls.
That makes sense.
There's Baby Poo Poo from Bill Cosby in the little basket.
Baby Poo Poo. You don't have to say that to me. Scott Trobaugh. Steve Vincent?
Oh, here we go.
Well, this is Scrambo.
Scrambo. I have never seen a baby. I have never seen a baby yet dressed in military fatigues.
He has a headband, he has a camouflage diaper.
Camouflage diaper.
Foot brush with death, even just 10 minutes. But his superior command of training and agility saved his life.
We expect great things from Scrambo. Kim Warren? Hamlet?
And then blue eyes and brown hair.
Baby Watts. Dave?
Yeah, that's my
baby's
name was already used. This is Benedict.
Benedict, that's okay.
You can call him Babes. And the only thing I have to say is he's such a beautiful baby because he has a beautiful mother.
Aww.
And Sharon Stevens.
This is Fred Astaire.
Fred Astaire.
He.
That's the top hat. Fred Astaire. Okay.
Great.
That's good. Let's see.
Yeah, he'll be going to Hollywood soon.
I just hope he can dance if you drop him. We'll be interested as we continue to see how we got this veterans row over here who had kids to see how your experience with the eggs comport with the real thing. We'll have a discussion. I'm going to say this to you: as you go along the week, you're probably going to find it's going to get on your nerves.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun going in, but after a while, it really gets the babies get on your nerves. And you'll develop a sense of, you'll be glad, well, how long do I have to, it's like a burden you can't ever get rid of, but that's exactly what babies are. Any questions? Yes?
Is the bedtime that you have the office at 11 o'clock?
Baby has to go to bed at 11.
My baby will be in bed earlier than my child needs more sleep.
Well, I'm trying to be reasonable with them. Listen, on the rule, I realize, I'll give you the project rules, and I realize that there are situations where, it's really going to be tough. But, you understand the spirit of this, and two or three people have talked to me about, some minor exceptions. Like, if you go to work, you either have to have a baby egg sitter, you can take it with you if you want, you put it up somewhere there, I realize things like that. But try to, don't turn generosity into license. I'm serious. For all the fun, I want you to take this seriously because I think you'll learn a lot. I think you'll learn something from it, and it will be, So stick as close to the project rules as you possibly can. Yes.
If we're not allowed to take this work, we have a problem with our boss, with our babies.
Yeah.
Can we have to pay our egg sitters?
Not unless you don't have to pay if you can get in the volunteer.
Yeah,
it's up to you. But the point is, the egg either has to be in bed or it has to be under somebody's immediate care at all times. It's like a baby.
Does
Just give us all weekend ministries and anything else with it.
To the beach, wherever you go. It's like a baby. You understand? You just you can't just walk off and leave
them. It'll fry.
It'll fry.
Okay,
now, any other questions? You all understand what's required of you now? A week from today, the essays are due, yes.
We don't have to give them a little letter.
No. But you have to change the baby. How, twice a day I have the rules? Change the baby every 4 hours. And I want those babies kept clean. Now, if you drop them, I've had them come in with scotch tape and well, they got cracked, and I had one that came in one time that had more scotch magic tape than there was shell just about. But be very careful, can't drop a baby, you know, because the problem is they're so, you know, I recommend you might want to tie your, if somebody asked me this, the thing on your wrist has to be with you or tied to your wrist. You can tie the, if it's in the basket, you can tie the basket to your wrist. That might make it easier for you. You're going to find this gets to be not so much fun. I'm serious. As the week goes on, you have to hold it and talk to it. I bet you nobody. Of course, you might want to eat them anyway. But after a whole week, you couldn't bring yourself to fry these things because it develops
attachments for you.
Yeah, that's right. Don't do that. Okay. Now let's go on to something else. Let's, if there are no questions about your project, did you all benefit at all from Linda, my wife, coming down and sitting in? She didn't know what she did. I left it up to her. But did you have any follow-up questions on the session with Linda, or any comments on it that you, upon reflection? Anyone? Okay. Let's go back to our syllabus then. The bottom of page 25. We're talking about the gracious word, and I was emphasizing the fact that a tone or a chemistry or a climate is created in the home by the spoken word, and we can operate by grace or by law. We can choose to get our minds back together on the where we were before. We can choose to emphasize the negative, or we can choose to be gracious. And this is very, very important. Now, it's a matter of choice. We're not talking about, to repeat myself, some Pollyannish kind of unreality. We're talking about a little grace and dignity. Let me say this to you, that homes... You ever notice this, that many people treat absolute strangers with more courtesy than they treat members of their own family? And one of the goals in the home, I recommend, is that we don't push familiarity too far. There needs to be maintained in the home, although there is the familiarity of a family, the intimacy, there needs to be maintained a certain level of dignity and order and grace. By that I mean... some of the social amenities that the kind of which we often reserve for the outside world ought to be observed in the home. Such things as common courtesies, please and thank you, and respect for privacy, just a little of the dignity in the home. A home ought not to become just bedlam and be some order. Well, coming out of the art of giving compliments, which is an expansion of this thing of the gracious word, and people live or die on the spoken word in the home. First of all, I'm trying to be very practical. When you give compliments, seize the moment. Do not get in the habit of thinking what you, I wish I'd said this. Say it at the time. Get in the habit. Honey, you look nice. That's a good supper. Have I told you lately I'm proud of you? And one of the smartest things you can do, this is very important, men especially, but women as well, is you can build up your mate in the eyes of your children.
A man who tears down his wife, or a woman who tears down her husband in the presence of the children, is fouling his own nest. You are financing your own misery, to switch metaphors. That is, if you're, I know a lot of parents who have lost control over their children. The children no longer respect the parents because of what the parents have said to each other in the presence of the children. For instance, if you think your wife is intelligent, tell your kids. You say, listen to your mother. She's a smart woman. She knows what she's talking about. You see what I'm saying? In other words, if the husband and wife build up each other and the kids are listening, this will increase respect that the children have for the parents. One of the ugliest, meanest, silliest, stupidest things I've ever seen. I've seen it happen. Is where a husband and wife systematically dismantle each other and then wonder why the children don't respect either one of them. Do you realize this, ladies? That the day is going to come when you're going to really need your children to respect their father. But they're not going to respect him one bit more than you do. They will not do it. Okay. Focus upon the person rather than the object of the deed. That's smart. You do that even in criticism. We're talking about compliments now. Focus on the person rather than the object of the deed. That is because that tends to enable you to operate by grace more than by law. You can sometimes you focus on the object of the deed. You say, "Honey, that was an unusually good supper tonight." But normally you can focus on the person as well. You can say, "Honey, I sure appreciate the way you go the second mile for me and the kids. I know you didn't feel like you were tired today, and this kind of meal was above and beyond the call of duty." Focus on the person. Be creative. And remember, by creative I mean don't say the same thing over and over. And remember the value that the compliment has for the giver. That is, when a compliment is given, the kind word, the gracious word is spoken in the home, something happens to the one receiving it, but something also happens to the one giving it. Do you realize that you become gracious by doing gracious things? Understand? The habit of speaking the gracious word in the home has a transforming effect upon the person doing the speaking. And again, it's a habit. Is this making sense to you? You become something different in yourself. Now, let's hear the art of giving compliments. And men are not very good at giving compliments. Women are lousy at receiving compliments. That's one of the things I had to teach my wife. She's taught me more than I ever taught her. Now, if you give a man a compliment, he immediately agrees with it. He believes it. Men are arrogant. Have I said this before? Men are arrogant. I'll say it again. Yes. I'm not, but other men are. You pay a man a compliment, he immediately thinks you're right. Friends, you say to a preacher, "That was a good sermon," he really thinks it was. In fact, he not only thinks it was, he says to himself, "It was better than you thought it was. It was not only as good as you thought, it was even better." You tell a man he looks nice, he knows it. Honey, you're a good husband. He already knew that. Men are arrogant. Most men. Yes, they got a real problem. Now, women, on the other hand, and I don't know why, they tend not to believe compliments. You pay a woman a compliment, and she will often do one of two or three things. But women tend to be less secure. Did you ever know a woman, by the way, fellas? Do you ever know your wife, usually your marriage students, to ever look at a photograph of herself and say, "That's an excellent photograph, it looks just like me"? I have never heard a woman who ever liked a photograph of herself. I've never heard her say that. They always say, "Oh, that doesn't look a thing like me. I don't take a good picture." They just don't. It's interesting. And women, so ladies, this is primarily to you ladies, men too, but primarily to ladies. If you get a compliment, don't refuse it. Oh, you're just saying that. Honey, I really like the way you look. Oh, you're just saying that. Or something. Now, suppose ladies, your husband came in. You picture this if you're not married, with a beautiful gift one evening, and he says, I've been thinking about you all day and I thought I'd give you a gift, and he hands it to you, it's all wrapped up real nice, and you take it from him and you throw it on the floor and you stomp it and you grind it under your heel and you say, okay honey, our supper's ready. And he looks at his gift that he just brought you, you know, squashed on the floor. Question: how long would it be before you got another gift? But you see, a compliment is a gift, and a compliment, and men do not like giving a compliment and then having to explain it or having to defend it. Honey, you look nice. Oh no, I don't. Why are you saying that? What have you done now? Do not refuse it. Do not analyze it. You know, men, all, you know, I used to make this mistake. Honey, she'd say, honey, I really liked your sermon. Oh, what'd you like about it? The first, she's like, the introduction, you know. Like, you know, you see, don't analyze it. Don't discount it. You pay a woman a compliment, and most women are born explainers. Men tend not to do that. You say, that's a beautiful dress. Chances are she'll tell you where she got it. Honey, you sure look nice. Well, I got this at a garage sale. Those are beautiful. That's a beautiful necklace. Well, they aren't real. Right, fellas? That's what women do. They'll say, what they're doing is they're taking your compliment and marking off 30%. Discounting it. That was a good meal. You say to a woman, that's a good meal, and if there's anything wrong, she'll bring it up. She'll say, well, the potatoes weren't quite done. I'm not making this up, am I? This is exactly what women tend to do, most women. No matter how, why, I don't know why. And so, I got a joke to my wife and myself. She's a great explainer and a discounter, and I had to teach her. I kid my wife. I said I believe if she ever actually really looked perfect, there wasn't a thing wrong with her. I mean, she's absolutely perfect. And I said, honey, you look great. She'd say, yeah, but I go in ragged underwear. You know, if you really knew, I'm not really as, you know, I look good on the outside, but not really. And so I taught my. So here's how you receive a compliment, ladies. You say thank you, as I say in the syllabus. Very simple, thank you. Understand? Don't ask if your man gives you a compliment, don't ask him to defend it or explain it or repeat it. Now if you haven't got one for a long time, you may be tempted to ask him to repeat it because you won't get one for a while. But just say thank you. And I had to teach my wife this. As I say, she taught me more than I've ever taught her. But I did teach her this. I'd repeat after me, thank you. I'd give her a compliment, and she'd start explaining it. I'd say, stop right there. And repeat after me, thank you, she'd say. Thank you. And she learned to receive a compliment. And I still have to do it so often. Why? I don't know why that is. You may not agree with this, but it's very true. The art of giving a compliment and the art of receiving it. Do you understand what I'm teaching you? Men tend not to have that problem. You say, honey, you look great tonight. He knows it. He says, yeah, thank you. He just assumes that you're right. It's very true. Okay, any questions on that? We move on now to the next principle of make time to live, I call this. Make time to live. Time is that vital element, look, I'm reading now, that makes the application of sound principle, some of which we've been studying, possible by creating a context, an opportunity to make the family work. That is, you can know the principles of family life, you can master them, you can work on them, but the one element you have to have is time. It doesn't do any good to know how to raise kids if you don't take the time to do it. It doesn't do any good to learn how to be a good wife or how to be a good husband, how to make a family work, if you do not give it the time. Time is the one element that must be in every formula. It's the one figure which must be in every equation. It's the sine qua non, without which not. You've got to have time. Now, Dobson says that overcommitment is the number one marriage killer. I don't think he's right about that, but at least he is right insofar as it is a very serious problem. And it's becoming more so. Why? Especially when you're young and starting out. You tend to flit here and there, and you are very busy. It's very hard to go to school and work and have a ministry and have time for your family, isn't it? Very, very difficult. But I would say this to you, that it doesn't get any better. One of the myths of college life is, when I get out of college, I'm going to have more time. You really don't. You don't have more time. Overcommitment is a respectable sin, first of all. What makes it respectable? Well, it looks like you're dedicated. You're a responsible person. You're willing to take on jobs that other people don't take. You see, it is respectable to say yes. One of the hardest things to do in the ministry is to learn how to say no. Learn to say, no, I'm not going to do it. It's hard in life in general. A person who cannot say no, a person of ability who cannot say no, will find himself overcommitted. And it seems like it seems wrong to say no. Sometimes we say yes because we feel guilty saying no, don't we? But you have to learn how to say, no, I cannot do this. I'm not going to do this. Now, and it's a sin that is deadly because, as I say in the syllabus, it lurks in the future. That is, it's easy today to ignore the pitfalls in overscheduling tomorrow. Very simple today to say, yes, I will do it next month. But next month, have you noticed, has a way of becoming this month? The future has this nasty habit of arriving. The future, which is nebulous and can be anything, has a way of becoming the sweet by and by has the way of becoming the nasty here and now, and it's full of facts and hard realities. And the point is, you wish you'd overcommitted yourself. Here are time myths, and they're made doubly dangerous, as I say, because they contain a strong element of legitimacy. You know, as you know, the worst kind of lie is the lie that has a strong element of truth in it. And so these are myths. These have just enough truth in them to make them doubly dangerous. The first myth is the end of the tunnel myth. You heard this one? Well, I'm busy right now, but I can see light at the end of the tunnel. Just as soon as I graduate, as soon as I get through this quarter, as soon as I get through this project at work, just as soon as I get settled, then I'm going to have time. Now, is there an element of truth in that? There is. There are times in our life when the pressure is on us more than at other times. Is that not true? It is true. So there's an element of truth in that. But the overall truth is that it doesn't work. Question, what is at the end of most tunnels? Answer, another tunnel. You ever notice this? Another tunnel. You have certain things claiming your time, your extra time, and you think, boy, as soon as this is done, I'm going to have that extra time to spend with my family. Have you noticed that something, that time is like a vacuum? As soon as you get this thing done, something else will rush in to claim the time you thought you were going to have. You've noticed that? That's life. I thought I was going to have more time starting in June. And look where I am. I'm right back where I started. It's especially true when you get out in the ministry. You know, any time is like a vacuum. Something comes in and fills it up. So, if there's nothing, so the safe assumption, even though there are times when there's less pressure on you, take that as a bonus. Take that as icing on the cake. Follow what I teach is follow the general rule that there's nothing at the end of the tunnel but another tunnel. So if you're going to do it, you have to do it now. Now you can't always do that, but that if you follow that general rule, if you realize that there is another tunnel at the end of this, if you know that's true, isn't it? There's another tunnel at the end of this tunnel. The second time myth is, this is a biggie today. I hate this one. It's not the quantity of time that's important, but the quality. Heard that one? In fact, we've got this phrase that's come into our language, quality time. Listen to me, there is no such thing as quality time. If you mean a time that somehow, even though it's short, because of its character, it will make up for quantity. And so if you believe this, then repent. Just change your mind, forget it. Why? Well, let me talk to you about this. First of all, dealing with children especially, what you think is quality time is not necessarily what they think is quality time. And we simply cannot be good enough parents in 20 minutes to make up for the kind of parenting that takes hours. There's nothing you can do. I don't care how powered the time is. There's nothing you can do in an hour and a half that's going to equal 20 or 30 hours that you need to spend with your family. Understand? It does not calculate. And sometimes you just have to be there. Let me tell you a story, family story. And I learned a great lesson from this about quality time. When LeAngela, most of you know LeAngela, since you haven't been gone that long, when she was, I think, in the fifth grade, maybe the sixth grade, this is up in Ohio, we went to one of these parent-teacher days, and our teacher called us over and said, I want to show you something. She found when she knew who we were. And she said, I've been teaching for, I think she said 20 years, something like that. I've never seen anything like this. She had an assignment that she always gave. She said, What's your favorite memory? And she said that kids would usually talk about the time they went to Disney World or, you know, some Hey Hallelujah time. These are very expensive, some special time. And and LeAngela at that time had been across the country three times that she could remember. She'd been to Disney World, World's Fair, Grand Canyon. She'd had a lot more Hey Hallelujah times than those kids. All kinds of these. And I would think it would be hard for her to pick which one of those was her favorite memory, because we'd gone camping in the mountains and done all kinds of things. You know what her favorite memory was? It's interesting. This kid had been, you know, had a lot of these what I call Hey Hallelujah times. You know what I mean by that? You know, these special quality times that people speak of. She told this story. This is what she wrote. And we've got this. We keep a file on stuff like this on our kids. Now the background of what she's going to say. My wife cannot stand. Ever lived up north? Any of you? You know, someplace up there, you see the sun maybe 60 days out of the year. It'll go a whole week at a time and just drizzle and be cold in the wintertime, just mucky, miserable. You don't have that in Florida very often. And so my wife cannot stand that. It's very depressing. So in those days, it'd get like that. She'd have me light a fire in the fireplace. We had a fireplace. I'd light a fire in the fireplace before I left that morning. And she'd close the window, close the curtains, and light candles. She's a great candle lighter. And put music on the stereo and just keep it out. It was very depressing. Anyway, so he said, this is her favorite memory. She said, came home from school one day. She had about a quarter of a mile walk and it was wet and drizzly. Since I came in the house and there was a fire in the fireplace and there was music playing and my mother had just baked some cookies.
And I came in and she said to me, here, take off your coat and sit in front of the fire and drink some hot chocolate and warm up before you change your clothes. That's it. I wasted all that money on Disney. A cup of hot chocolate would have done it. Now, of course, we couldn't know this. That was her favorite memory. You know, the feeling of going home, mother being there, the atmosphere. And we couldn't, now of course, we couldn't, now her favorite memory was something we couldn't even remember. That day faded into many other days. What do you think about that? A child's favorite memory was an event that the parents couldn't remember if you tortured them. What does that say to you? It said to me that what we think is quality time is not necessarily what children think is quality time. For instance, you get little boys, we think what's quality, we think quality time is taking them fishing. And that is, they love that. But often quality time is taking a few minutes to play Cowboys and Indians with them when they ask you to when you come home from work. See what I'm saying? This distinction between quality and quantity is an adult, phony, arbitrary, artificial distinction that doesn't work on kids. And you need to be there. I talk about be where the being is. I talk about that in here. I don't think I did. Somebody asked about time. I know it came up. Somebody asked about should mothers work? And I talked about this. You see, think about quality versus quantity of time. It takes quantity to raise kids. It takes quantity of time to form this bonding that I talked about. Somebody stop me. I don't want to repeat myself. Did I share the phrase? I didn't make a note. You got to be where the being is. You heard that phrase? I got this from my father-in-law who got it from his dad. Who was a pioneer preacher. By the way, his dad, the guy who thought this up, was the guy that converted Raccoon John Smith. His name was Asa Maxey. And he came out of Eastern Kentucky, and out of the hills. And he had raised a whole family of missionaries and ministers. He had a saying that he got out of the hills: "You got to be where the being is." You know what he meant by that? I'll share it with you. You got to be where the being is. That is, there are times when things come up, and you've got to be there then. It doesn't, and you can't make up for it later. You got a kid who's got a problem. His problem is then. And if you got a kid who's got a problem he needs to talk about, that's where the being is, and you need to be there. When a second grader, a first grader, comes home from school with their first real victory of any kind, and they want to tell somebody, they want to tell their parents, right then, that's where the being is, and you got to be there. Now, you can't always be there. I know that. The principle is you've got to be where the being is. It's time to be there. Now, you'll face this in your ministries, in Christian service. There's going to be times when the church is going to say to you, you need to be here. And you're going to have to say, no, I got something involving my child, and I've got to be there. Where are you going to be? Well, the question is, where's the being? And you got to be where the being is. And let me tell you, this is very, very important. Do any of you have memories? I don't want to get too personal, and we don't want to turn this to a criticism class. Do any of you have memories of a time when you really needed your mate, or you needed your parents, and you just didn't have them, and later on it didn't make any difference? A lot of kids, well, you understand the principle? And therefore, you see, you can't make up, if you're not there when it's time to be there, you can't make up for it with some expensive quality time later on. This doesn't balance out. And it takes time to raise children.
and to be a mate. Women know this. By the way, men are more tuned into quality time versus quantity. Women are less tuned into it. Women know better than men do that it takes time to develop a husband-wife relationship. A man thinks he can come in, take care of business, and move on. This is atomistic. A woman knows you can't do that. What I'm saying is this to you, fellas. Your wife, she has more of a sense of the need of quantity of time, probably, than you do. Yes?
How much time would you suggest that a husband and wife with their children would say that they, at the minimum, would be together or be separate from their
children? You mean just husband and wife together or with the children? Without children? I that's a good question. I don't have a good answer. I hesitate to say hour, you know, to count hours. But let me just answer it this way, that first of all, the woman needs more time than he does. There's that woman, the man does not have this sense of needing a lot of time. And so we operate from the woman's point of view on this, is that however much time she needs to feel close to her husband. And there needs to be, I would say, needs to be a few hours during the week of uninterrupted time. You know, hours on end. I said, it's very hard to do. Especially when you're going to school and working and everything. But listen, marriages suffer if there's not enough time. What happens is, by the way, you see this in microcosm with the engaged couples. Remember I said before, engaged couples, if they have just a little bit of time, they tend to expect too much out of that time. Couples who see themselves not, who's a couple who are going together, or even married couples who are so busy.